netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this episode, Mike Seymour talks with Alana Newell, CEO of Crafty Apes, about her path from compositor to studio leadership, offering a look at what it takes to manage a growing multi-office global studio in these days. Now, Newell discusses how Crafty Apes balances business strategy with creative culture, the role of machine learning in optimizing studio workflows, and the financial dynamics of scaling VFX companies. She also shares her vision for expanding beyond traditional film and episodic television into immersive content creation and more. So let's go ahead and cross that conversation now.
Anna, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I got to say, I've been really looking forward to talking to you at so many levels. This may come as a surprise to you, but we actually have weird similarities of stuff. I started as a compositor. Obviously, you started as a compositor. You're now in management, and I'm obviously going to be discussing that at great length for you today. But you did an MBA. I actually myself did an MBA. You were in Sydney. I obviously am based in Sydney. So like, this is a really phenomenally interesting opportunity to talk to you. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you very much for having me. That's really exciting.
Hey, so you've moved obviously from creative and artist to management. What did you kind of have to leave behind in that transition?
I think the main thing that I had to leave behind, which I get now in other ways, is the immediacy of a win. So as an artist, and you would know too, we love a final, right? It really gets us going for the next one and that achievement. And then you see your work in theaters, you see your name in credits. And so getting that experience of accomplishment, I think it's very different when you're in management. Every win, in my opinion, is my team's win. It's a collective success, and it's several steps removed from the initiation of whatever you set out to accomplish, right? It could take years to get the win that you're going for and what you're trying to accomplish. I think every error, mistake is something that I personally wear a little bit of as well, because I'm somewhat responsible for the output of the entire company. So I think that's a piece that I still get at home. I still carry the craft and still endeavor in creatives every day to kind of hold on to that. I think you also lose a little bit of that flow state. I think, you know, as a compositor, you would love to just sit there in the deep darks and work quietly on something.
Yes, I have to confess, I obviously run a research lab now in addition to FX Guide, and there is a deep resonance of success that you get. Like, it's very satisfying. But I will confess that there were late nights when I finally nailed a shot when it was like midnight and there was no one else around, and I literally stood up and danced. I'm a very bad dancer, but I was just that joyous in the moment. So the flip side of that is, so you're got a large company and you're bidding big projects. Like, what do you feel like you bring stuff to those bids that you only got because you had that artist background?
Yeah, I think my perspective is particularly unique because I know exactly what it took to execute that work. And so I can have a different perspective on what the risks are, where the potential for error can go, and be able to prepare the team in a different way, be able to prepare, to communicate what that's going to be and be able to see that across a large number of projects and the impacts of that. So it's definitely a unique perspective. It also gives me perspective on what the artists are going through and a unique perspective of what the company is going through at given times, because I've experienced it myself as an artist. So it allows me to communicate to them in different ways, which generally they tell me they appreciate that I'm quite transparent, because that's how I wanted someone to talk to me when I was a compositor.
So how big is Crafty Apes now?
So we're 8 offices, about 400 people globally.
You're probably aware that the image that Crafty Apes has is being really good, a bit scrappy, very kind of nimble. And I'm really interested in that, like, sort of view that you sort of felt like you came a bit more from as a company from doing invisible effects and great work, and now you're sort of doing more full range stuff. What's the vision for what you'd like to see Crafty Ames known at? And do you agree with my characterization of how you're seen in the industry at the moment?
Oh, I absolutely agree with it. That is what we strive to be, is crafty in everything that we do and taking things from that lens. Moving from that traditional visual effects, invisible visual effects, into a broader range is definitely been the goal. And it feeds to our nimbleness, right? My vision is that Crafty Apes can win an Emmy nomination, say with The Residents last year. This year we're nominated for three. But we can also do that scrappy project that has passion and it has love, but it may not have the same budget, and work with our clients in a different kind of way, and helping them achieve their goals with the budgets that they have, and being able to oscillate between those two things and provide a unique experience bespoke experience to certain project is really, to me, what embodies being crafty.
So your company is quite large now, right? It's not quite like, you know, at the kind of level of what I'd call the, you know, Framestore ILM kind of majors, but you're definitely getting up there. The thing is, though, you've got institutional investors. You've got like proper, you know, major funds that have invested in your company, you know, both before you were CEO and since. And the question I guess I'm asking you is, before you were in Rising Sun in Australia, which we mentioned a moment ago, you were at Rhythm and Hughes. Rhythm and Hughes won an Oscar and couldn't stay in business. Generally around the world, companies are struggling to fight for a sensible and reasonable amount of compensation for the great work they do. At the same time, trying to hold staff against the line of AI companies and tech companies that are willing to offer sort of, you know, football player salaries. What makes Crafty Apes attractive to an institutional investor? And like what's that pitch? Like, because you can't be pitching a, you know, 10x or 100x multiplier that a IT AI startup is doing. What's the vibe?
Well, when Crafty was, got institutional money, as did a number of visual effects companies all around the same time during what we'll call, you know, just pre-streaming wars, the fact was that new technology had come in. A lot of money was being spent on content. There has been a definite change. The conversation for us is really about how diversified we are. And I think that's a key piece to it, right? You know, we talk about Rhythm and Hughes, one of the strongest cultures in company cultures in this industry. If you meet someone from Rhythm and Hughes today, there's still this bond of like, you were there, I was there. Did you know so-and-so? Have you worked with so-and-so? There's a people first company, absolutely. And they struggled, obviously, in financial bankruptcy and all of those places. I think part of it is really that you've got to be able to do a range of projects, right? Like, ultimately, content is in the consumers and what they want to watch. And if you are in a specific piece of that market, and that market gets smaller, even if just temporarily, you could be greatly exposed. And so being able to have a diverse range from, you know, Sphere to Jumanji, but also just to your key projects that you wouldn't even know had visual effects, and being able to balance between those so that you really keep an ultimate utilization across the company is a key part of it. You know, if you're tied to five projects and one pushes, it could be a great risk. Whereas if you're tied to 50 and two push, you're not as exposed.
There's a real risk of having a gorilla client that if they decide to walk away, you suddenly have a massive hole in your cash flow.
But that's right.
Is it not the case that one would expect that investors generally want growth and to see like massive growth? And if that's the case, is VFX able to offer that kind of growth? And if it can't, what does that say?
So it depends on who your investors are. We're not owned by private equity. So our investors have a bit of a different appetite, and one for long-term sustainability and growth. And so that makes the conversations a lot more pragmatic. I think long-term, especially with the new technology, there's new opportunity to spread.
Is that able to happen inside the current business model, which is pretty much, I mean, it's not, but it's pretty much like an sort of a rate card hourly kind of mentality? Or do you need to get to a pricing on value, pricing on contribution kind of model?
Yeah, I mean, the day rate model definitely has some inherent flaws in it. The way I look at it is you're likely not going to change that in terms of what the expectations are, but it's not to say that you can't make it more profitable and that you can't make it more successful. I think that when you start looking at other businesses and other industries and how it's modeled, bidding is always a challenge, right? And granted, the more subjective, the more challenging it can be, but there is a way to make it successful within the same model. And I think that one of the key pieces to do that is actually engaging in machine learning. We're all looking at generative AI when we talk about visual effects, but the amount of data that we sit on in terms of how long something takes from a scheduling perspective, from a pure duration perspective, actually allows us to optimize the type of work we take and therefore optimize our overall execution.
Well, you mentioned AI there, and I'd like to unpack that a bit. Like you, I don't like the idea of talking about AI. I like the idea of talking about the specific tools, like the machine learning tools, the sort of segmentation tools, all the different types of tools are vastly different than the LLM prompting that kind of the popular press kind of focuses on. Mm-hmm. So you guys did a lot of work on the Spheres production of Wizard of Oz, which was a massive undertaking of both AI in its various forms and traditional effects. What lessons did you get from learning on that?
Well, internally, the main lesson was how capable we were. I think being able to pivot and take on different technological challenges and overcome them and how to overcome them and seeing how quickly our internal teams could support the artists into executing was some of the bigger pieces. I think immersive is becoming a real platform and a real piece for engaging in content. And it really comes down to understanding the capability of all the different facets of the technology and where there's limitations to every technology, and it's understanding what they are, communicating them effectively, and working around them and working with them to what their best attributes are to executing the final image. That makes sense.
Yeah. If I'm not wrong, you hired recently a chief innovation officer. Is that an AI play in the broad sense?
No, it's a way for me to encompass a very smart person into a big bucket of whatever can come down your way that falls into the technology bucket. I always have some fun titles in there. We actually work together in Australia as well. And it generally encompasses pipeline technology, CG. It even encompasses our bidding applications, like the bidding app, crew planning, all sorts of different functions, our CRM, and machine learning and AI. And so it encompasses all of it together, because in reality, the visual effects pipeline is not a bug to machine learning. It's a feature. And it's something that when you combine those two pieces right, you actually get the optimal performance.
One of the things that's been discovered with the serious use of AI tools, and again, not talking about LLMs and prompting and writing documents, is as you get into using good agentic workflows and stuff, you tend to find that people extend out from a narrower definition. So this is outside the visual effects industry. So they tend to do more things that are maybe not quite in the narrow definition of what their job is. Is that something that you've seen reflected in visual effects, or do you think that visual effects is still in the domain of wanting to have more specialists as opposed to generalists?
Crafty, one of the main things are is that we have a lot, much higher number of generalists than the average company. We try to avoid being overly specialized in any space because it makes resourcing the work much more complicated. And so somebody always has a capability somewhere else in the toolbox. So in general, I think I agree with you that the new technology is pushing farther on the generalist front because you've got to be able to understand the different facets that you can use it. And you have to be able to apply it to various different areas to be able to be successful. I mean, specialists are still a critical aspect and they are key to our success. So we have a mix. We have a mix of people. And for me, it's not actually what department they sit in. It's what skill sets do they have? What unique skill sets does that individual bring? And how do you allocate the right work to make them most successful?
So recently I was talking to a mutual colleague of ours, Ben Grossman, and he was saying that he thinks at the moment with the, and Magnopus has been pivotal at using AI, especially with things like the Sphere. He was saying that he thinks that the pressure at the moment is actually on getting talent. Like talent is the issue with AI, not replacing people, which is the populist kind of sort of discourse, but actually getting people that are able to work in a area where it's constantly changing and also remain focused on what sort of the client actually wants and doing that. Now, you've had this attitude in the press previously about really wanting to train and promote from within. So how are you incorporating those new skills, given that, like you, I think we both agree, like the people are the thing that are making this work or not work. Mm-hmm. Are you able to do that from internally still, or do you need to go externally and start pulling people in?
Yeah, it's a good point. So I do really fundamentally believe in allowing the crew you have internally to develop and grow and have opportunities to grow. That doesn't mean that everything we do is always going to be internally developed. You need external stimulus to spark new ideas, to spark change, to provide experience from different areas and apply it to a unique way inside the company. So I fundamentally think that you have to have both. Not training internally, and by training and for visual effects, I think training is offering new opportunities of growth, right? Like with tight margins, we don't have an entire academy of training that happens, you know, 20 hours out of the week or 10 hours out of the week. What we have is, because we have such a wide range of projects, it allows these appropriate stepping stones of like, okay, you've tried this, let's try this one. It has the next kind of level of opportunity. And machine learning goes in the same space. I have talent that is extraordinary that was homegrown, and we're very lucky to have had them. And they've had that curiosity that has allowed them to really embrace machine learning. And I've got talent that needs to be exposed to that curiosity through tangible projects, right? Everybody learns slightly different. The talent comment about machine learning is, to the extent that I don't think you're just going to put out an ad and find somebody that has 5 years experience in this, because nobody has 5 years experience in, right? So you're really looking for a mindset. You're looking for a type of person. And fortunately, because I think it's been ingrained in us for so long, and that was the culture of the company, that we had a number of people internally that could evolve into that space. So that pool of people is growing every quarter. You're getting more people that are like, look what I made, look what I tried. Could we use this in ShotGrid? Could we use this in our bidding app? And giving them space to bring their ideas to the top is I think what's the most important. It's not to say if I didn't find talent, I wouldn't recruit. I absolutely would, because I think external ideas is critical also to a healthy business. Otherwise, you become an island without that external stimulus. So you've got to find a balance.
Crafty isn't adverse to occasionally doing company level acquisitions, I think molecular, mm-hmm. but would you see the path forward in perhaps acquiring companies, or is it more like, I think what you did in Sydney is just open an office and then hire people into the team, presumably people that you might have known from Adelaide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it really depends on the uniqueness of a territory and the uniqueness of what we're trying to build, right? Like if there's an area that I don't have the experience and I don't have the expertise and it's very unique, I would do an acquisition over an organic growth model because it takes a very long time. And honestly, sometimes works out to be the same amount of money when you're trying to discover a territory versus knowing it already. So Australia was natural for me because whether I'd worked with them or not, their reputation spoke for themselves. And once I was able to bring in our creative director, Adam Paschke, and our head of studio, Jeanette Manifold, I knew that that office was going to be a success because I knew that they embodied the same mentality that I did. That was a really important factor.
You have multiple branches for a company that's, you know, medium in size. This is a reflection, and I think you've said this, of tax concessions and mm-hmm. and how much is that like just the way that you have to exist now? And does that mean that people in those offices have to be aware that shifts in legislation could mean shifts in location for them?
So, I mean, tax credits are a fundamental to visual effects, right? And I think we try to avoid talking about them. I'm not particularly shy at acknowledging that because I think it's an important factor for everyone to be aware of how the model works. With that being said, I wouldn't go into a location that I thought was going to be fundamentally dependent on just the tax credit. Like there's other factors that have to go into it. They need to be standalone regardless of whether credits change in other locations, and there needs to be some stability for that location. So there's plenty of tax credits out there that I wouldn't necessarily engage in because it may not have other important factors in small market. So it is a factor, but it's not the end all be all. I fundamentally don't want to open a studio to 2 years later close it because yeah. The rate slightly changed.
But I mean, the numbers we're talking about, like let's take Sydney, and I know it well because I obviously live here. Like if you're operating in New South Wales for any company, not yours, just in particular, it's mm-hmm. like a 40% tax credit, 30% mm-hmm. national, 10% state. Like a 40% difference is an enormous amount of money on a relatively tight margin business. Well, I would say very tight margin business. So, but both sides of the equation know about that, right? Like, I mean, you know about it. Obviously, the companies that are commissioning you to do it know about it.
Yeah.
A society thinks that it's a worthwhile thing to do that, like the taxpayers, the electors of whoever's government is doing it thinks it's a good idea that we have a film industry, so we're going to do this. But does it end up kind of evening out at all in the sense that almost if you get sort of that level of tax credit but in multiple locations, then you're back to where you started before the tax credits?
So in the sense you're saying if you've got multiple locations, but that they
you've got like a choice between Canada, New Zealand, Australia, mm-hmm. you know, London, whatever. And
does it even out?
Yeah. And then it's like, well, everyone's going to have tax credits. So we get back to just, you know, a model that's a given. It's written in. It's like a taken for granted.
Yeah. Look, I don't know. I think that the reasons clients go to different locations isn't just tax credit, right? Then they would always just go to the highest one and there wouldn't be work in any other location. Like there's other attributes of really what they need to shoot, what they need to gather from that location outside of just the rebates, whether or not it evens itself out. I mean, we still have great work in LA and it doesn't necessarily have the highest tax credit. So there's other factors that keep work there.
It must make, though, the managing of larger projects kind of pretty interesting, if I can use that word, because like we're not just talking about where you are notionally opening an office. Like the actual employees have to be in that city. It's not, these are not like fake initiatives. They're like real initiatives to cause employment in those areas. So you can't like get a tax credit in Sydney and then have all the work, well, not all the work, but a part of the work off the books being done elsewhere. It just doesn't work like that. So you're kind of managing, like we've spoken a moment ago about the idea that if you had a guerrilla client and they went away, you'd have like a big gap and that can be fatal to some companies. But you're having to geographically do that as much as do it temporally over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it certainly makes things slightly more complicated. But if your goal is to be agile and available where your clients want you, then it's part of what that business model looks like, that agility to be present in the locations that they'd like to see you. And so the difference is too, though, is that Crafty has a lot of offices. It's still one company. And that, I think, is ultimately the most important. So there's no factions of these offices and those offices, and they work independently. We still work very collectively the same and together and share ideas and approaches. And so in the sense of where the rebate is, yeah, it does put work in certain spaces. But in the sense of how we execute, it's still very collective.
Which begs the question, you've got a corporate culture, but we're talking about people in actually different cultures. So do you see like VFX people as being pretty much the same in all your offices because they just a breed of visual effects artists and you know those people well? Or you're like, well, I need to treat my Australians differently from my, you know, people in America or whatever because they are fundamentally different countries, different nationalities.
Yeah, I think if you're a smart manager and actually look at who your people are and you know who they are and they're not just a name on a page, you acknowledge that those locations bring different strengths to the team. And so it's not that I fundamentally teach them differently, but that I might actually ask somebody from one location that I know has a lot more background in a certain type of project to come and support us in how we execute that kind of work.
Well, but that's skills, right? I guess what I'm asking about is how you manage them.
And managing, I don't know. I think at the fundamental, people want to do good work and they want to be acknowledged for doing good work. And, you know, ultimately, the culture differences come out in the wash when you treat them well. And when you treat your teams well, they treat their people well. And so for the most part, it's not generally an issue. There are culture clashes in the sense of, you know, people expect to work a certain way or communicate in a certain style. My expectation is that we acknowledge those differences and work with them. I mean, it's no different than any other global company. You would be fascinated, though. Like it is quite fascinating how unique even just the skill sets and the style and the culture is to each of these locations, because, you know, visual effects used to be very nomadic. And so people had worked all over the place. I mean, in Australia, I had four different cultures in the same office with me. And so we do get very accustomed on how to acknowledge the differences and appreciate them. I think that's kind of a natural thing for visual effects to some extent.
Yeah, I worked in London and I worked in Hollywood. And when I was in London, my manager said to me one day, he said, you should go and work in the American office. And I said, why is that? And he goes, well, you like to hear that you've done a good job. And that's an American trait. In England, we pay you to do a good job. So we're not going to say you've done a good job if you've done a good job, because we don't hire you to do a bad job. And to my ears, I was like, well, yeah, I quite like being told I've done a good job. And he goes, yeah, go work in the LA office.
Oh, gosh. That's funny. Yeah, I can certainly relate to that. And generally, it's communication. You know, I'll usually, it's more of an language style, especially when you're communicating on email or chat, on making sure to add a little bit of extra if you're talking to certain countries versus other countries. But the people have adapted because they've worked on cross projects. I mean, we have different locations and different rebates, but I could have a project in Australia that's also in Vancouver, and they could be working on it collectively together. And so there is a lot of experience that's built to have that camaraderie across offices. And that in itself brings external stimulus as well, just by having that exposure to different countries.
And in terms of projects, you mentioned earlier that you've got Jumanji Open World coming out. When you guys announced that, or someone in your PR team did, I remember them saying something like, we're really glad to be working with Sony again, all right? Like, we're back with Sony. And because you've done stuff with Sony before, you've done Spider-Man stuff, you've done, you know, like this. So I guess my question is, in that area of the film industry, there aren't that many studios. Mm-hmm. Is it really, not who you know as in a bad way, but like an incredibly important part of your role to just be fostering those relationships, because it is still, even at that level, a relationship game?
There's always relationships. I think I don't see it as just my role. I actually see it as every person that's in the company's role is to foster those relationships and those engagements. And I encourage them to support those relationships. But yeah, I mean, it's a challenging industry. And so your clients want to know that you see them and you're going to provide what they need at the end of the day, and that you are reliable, and that you go above and beyond for them. And that's all fundamental in that relationship.
You're naturally been appointed to your role based on your talent, your experience, and your competency. But it's unusual these days to have women in senior roles. It's not unheard of, but like visual effects supervisors, for example, they're predominantly male. What made the difference for you in being able to do that? Was there someone that mentored you? Was there something that sort of you saw as a pivotal step that meant that you got there?
I definitely had great role models and mentors to show me the way that were above me, even from my beginning careers at Rhythm and Hughes. And I think that was a fundamental piece. One of my first supervisors was a woman, and seeing that they could do it and how they did it gave me a path to progress. I also think there's always somebody behind you helping support, right? This is not a 9-to-5 gig most days. And there's a, you know, I get a lot of support from friends and family and the likes of that to be able to do it.
But in terms of managing, like there are a lot of women that are really good artists. There's just no question about it. But when it comes to supervisors, there are a lot less women. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of women that are producers and incredibly competent at that. Is there anything that's causing that other than just the way that it's played out, do you feel?
I think it's exposure to role models. I think that's one of the key pieces, to be honest. And in fact, when I was doing one of my courses in my MBA, one of the biggest learnings I had was it wasn't how many junior level or mid-level artists you had that were women. It was how many role models did they have to pave the path for where they were going. You need an example to show you how that path could go. And so I think that's a bit fundamental, but it's shifting. I mean, we have a few female supervisors now that are extraordinary, and they pave the way for the next ones to go through that.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Crafty has in any way got an imbalance. I'm just speaking in terms of the industry in general.
I mean, I think it's a matter of the number of role models to look after. I think it's changing, and it takes some time to change.
So with this broadening of the scope of what you can do, which we've discussed, and obviously you're global, how much is Crafty's future now looking forward still confined to what I would typically call episodic and feature? I mean, we used to sort of joke that people did, you know, features for the fame and the glory, and that would attract the talent, and you did episodic to make the money.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond those two, there is a lot of stuff. I mean, The Sphere is an example, which is not a traditional film. Yeah. And you mentioned immersive before. Like, how real are the opportunities to do things outside the constraints of what you'd call episodic television or features?
Oh, I think it's very real. And I think it's growing all the time. I think it requires a nimbleness and an ability to see a unique problem and apply a unique situation to it without breaking the bank, right? I'm not saying a unique situation that wipes out the pipeline and starts from scratch, but works with what you have and applying it to a new unique role. I mean, roller coasters is theme parks is a whole other space that we've been getting into as well.
Oh, really? What have you been doing with roller coasters? So I didn't know that.
We've got one project with Universal right now. But that's, you know, the same application as you would to Sphere, right? It's a large output using the same type of technology and medium that you would use. So I think there's a lot of pieces that you can get into. I think of Crafty as a content creation company, not just a visual effects company. If you need a visual created, we're there to create it for you.
So advertising used to be a huge source of revenue, but a lot of that mm-hmm. has sort of gone by the wayside, or at least fragmented tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be a world of interactivity, which mm-hmm. is less explored. Is that something that interests you? Because it's quite different doing interactive events, installations, activations than it is just doing a pre-rendered kind of completed piece, but the technology is allowing more for that.
Absolutely. That's exactly where I think more content will end up.
And yeah. What's the medium for that? Like, where do you see that coming from?
Where do I see that coming from? I think people are in general looking for more engagement. I think Sphere proved that they're looking for different ways to engage with content. And I think there's a lot broader out there to be able to execute profitably with the right approach to it. But that's just my speculation.
Well, just yours, but I mean, you are the person in charge of the company. Yeah. So. Your yeah. direction does kind of matter quite a lot.
I think that is where trends are going, right? I think that's something that, I mean, you see people going back to the theaters when that has now picked up again and is making, you know, a good progress towards people engaging more with theatrical releases. Yes, that's classic to the type of work we do, but it goes to show you that they're interested in being out there and engaging in different forms. I mean, you go to a museum now and the number of installations you see is far more than I remember when I was a kid.
But if we were unpacking that and just in closing, like look, this idea of looking forward, in the discussion we discussed before, like let's say you're doing work either on The Sphere or any other major feature film, you're not directly dealing with the client so much because the traditional structure is mm-hmm. that there's a production and that's between you and the studio. And even though you're obviously very friendly with the studio and talk to them, like there's a hierarchy and a layering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as you get into content creation, to use your example of a museum or whatever, you can be much more directly them talking to you. Like you don't have, not because you're trying to annoy anyone, but you just don't have those middle layers between you. Like, is that a service that you see growing for you, that this sort of direct contact with people just wanting to create stuff and coming to you directly?
I think it's actually quite a natural extension for us because a lot of Crafty's projects are supervisors working directly with the director on their vision for the project and how to accomplish their vision. So we don't always have sort of secondary pieces. There's a lot of projects that we're engaged in the story and what it is that they want to tell and how visual effects is going to support that story within, you know, their means to execute it. So it's a fairly natural piece for us to have to understand the entire picture and how visual effects plays a role in that picture. And that's because we work on such a broad range of projects. So that's, you know, that can come quite naturally to us.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us today. It's been fascinating to hear your thoughts on the industry, where it's going, and especially where Crafty is going. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you as well.
Well, thanks so much, Alana, for sharing your insights into the inner workings of a VFX company, as well as your thoughts on how to manage changes and uncertainty in this ever-changing industry. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.